I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver. This is thecommentary.ca. Stevie Cameron joins me now, the investigative journalist and best-selling author, has just published a big book on the farm, Robert William Picton and the Tragic Story of Vancouver's Missing Women. She was last on for her previous book on the case, The Picton File. We talked 3 years ago about that book, about this book, pardon me, as the last book was more of a memoir of her covering the case rather than the details of Picton, his life, the women who went missing, the murders, and the trial. This book on the farm covers all of that, as it's the first comprehensive book on the case. As a matter of fact, one of the trial's prosecutors said that this book is the Bible on the case. Stevie Cameron was a political correspondent for the Ottawa Citizen and the Globe and Mail. She was a host of the Fifth Estate, as well as the editor-in-chief of Elm Street magazine. Her previous books include On the Take, The Last Amigo, and Ottawa Inside Out. Her website is at steviecameron.com. On the Farm is published by Knopf. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Stevie Cameron. Good morning, Ms. Cameron.
Thank you, Joe. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Now, On the Farm, that wasn't supposed to be the title, right?
Well, it was going to be called The Pig Farm. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, because anybody that is, I wrote a book called The Last Amigo, which, and the title didn't, nobody understood what it was about. I thought, well, I'm not going to do that again.
Yeah.
You know, it was because Karlheinz Schreiber was one of the amigos for Franz Joseph Strauss, who was actually the chairman of Airbus, and this was the guy who managed all the payments, kickbacks on contracts and so on for Strauss. So there were two or three amigos around Strauss, and that's why we called him the last one. He's the last one alive. But, you know, the name was completely obscure to readers, and I thought, this time I'm going to make it clear what this is about. But my publishers didn't like The Pig Farm. They said people would recoil from it, and I suspect that's true. So I finally agreed to the one they to On the Farm.
Now, how long ago was this book ready?
Oh, about 10 days ago. No, I finished it in the spring, but there's an awful lot of work that has to be done in a manuscript as large as this, with fact-checking and, you know, proofreading, you know, little tweaks and so on. And so it really wasn't really ready till about the middle of the summer, and then we were setting it in type, and we were thrown by the fact that the trial judge decided to put some publication bans back on the case after the Supreme Court ruled. So we had to reset the type for the hardcover, and the e-book was quick to fix, but not the hardcover. So it's just been a long struggle this summer to get this book ready.
And the ban that you're talking about, that has to do with the person in the book named Sandra Gail Ringwald?
Yes, we had to find a name that was exactly the number of letters of the real person. The real person I mentioned a number of times in my earlier book, the memoir you mentioned earlier, called The Picton File, and the real name of that woman is on hundreds of websites that tell the story. But the trial judge decided that her name should be protected, which is just about unheard of after the Supreme Court rules on a case. That's that, unless there's a new trial. And there was no new trial in this case, so we were stunned by that, but we were forced to go back and change the name on the book.
Now, this person, Sandra Gail Ringwald, that's not a real name. She was involved how? The story?
Well, she's a wonderful witness. I watched her give her testimony, listened to it in the preliminary hearing in 2003, and she did not appear. The trial judge decided not to admit her testimony or bring her back as a witness in the trial. He decided that she was an unreliable witness. I think of all the witnesses I watched in the prelim and the voir dire and the trial itself, she was probably the most memorable. She was an extraordinary woman, very smart, funny. She was not on drugs when she was giving her testimony, but she was her recall was great. She's a great storyteller, and she talked about going out to the farm with Picton and when he tried to handcuff her, as he did with his victims, before he killed them, she began to fight with him and was able to stab him. They had a stabbing brouhaha. He was stabbed, she was stabbed, and they both ended up in hospital. So her her description of what happened to her that night was so damaging to Picton, that to Picton's case, that his lawyers fought very successfully to have it removed from the trial evidence, and that was a shame. So I wanted to tell her whole story.
And when was this incident with Picton? This was in the 90s?
It was in 1997, I believe.
Yeah. There were 26 charges recommended against Picton. Then when it went to trial, they decided to sever, which I guess means that they went for 6 rather than 26. And then there was supposed to be the second trial on the other 20 charges, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who decided that?
The trial judge. What actually happened was there were 27 counts. The trial judge threw out one, quashed one count, which was the count against Picton for the murder of Jane Doe. And Jane Doe was a woman whose skull was found in the Mission Slough, out near Mission, and it was some of her bones were found on the Picton farm, and the DNA matched. It took years for the police to find out who Jane Doe was. They never did discover her identity, but they did realize that she was a Picton victim because her bones were found on the farm. They matched the DNA. The trial judge decided to quash the count on Jane Doe for reasons I still don't understand. I do seem to remember him saying something about, we don't know who she is.
Mm-hmm. And so the families of the other, with regards to the other 20 charges, there's not going to be a second trial. You've talked to them. They're obviously angry, are they?
They're very upset. They were very upset when the trial judge severed the counts. And, you know, Jane Doe's family was not known. There was nobody there to complain about her. She was the only one of the women they weren't able to identify. The others were identified, many of them were, and we don't know if there were our remains on that property or under some of the townhouses nearby, but they certainly made a huge effort to get everything they could. So we had the identities of the other 26. The trial judge thought that no jury could stand to sit through the evidence on 26. He thought it would try their strengths and so on, and therefore he was going to cut it into 6 and 20. Now, why he didn't do it into, you know, 12 and 12 or 12 and, you know, 14,
yeah.
I don't know, but that's the way he did it, and he got 6, and so the family's very, very upset, and they were promised a new trial, and then eventually the attorney general of the day, Wally Opal, decided that enough was enough, and the 6 would be it. They wouldn't try. Have a second trial.
Now, is Picton appealing these convictions on the 6?
He did appeal, and it went to the Supreme Court of Canada. It took them quite a long time to make a decision, and they made a decision this past August, just a few weeks ago, and they decided there would be no new trial. In other words, Picton lost at the Supreme Court. So that was when the publication bans were finally lifted on all the material from the preliminary hearing, which I attended, and the voir dire. And so that's when the public finally heard the stories we'd heard so many years ago, because so many of the stories were withheld when there were only 6 counts.
Now, knowing what you know and having seen what you saw back then and seeing what's happened with the trial, would a publication ban have changed anything, do you think?
I don't understand. How do you mean? Would it?
Like, would we have? I understand why they have publication bans, because they don't want to taint juries or whatever. Do you think that what happened at the trial would have changed? Had we known what?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think so. I think the evidence was overwhelming. But we had a hung jury. I mean, we had a juror who was holding out, and I think that's why we got a second-degree murder verdict. But it was a difficult jury, and the judge had to reprimand this one juror who looked quite pleased with the second-degree murder verdict while all the rest of the jury was crying. It was a very odd situation. But the bans are just a, you know, the publication bans that were imposed are just simply a matter of law. No way around them. The preliminary hearings are always under a publication ban until they're lifted, and they weren't lifted until very recently, just a few weeks ago.
Now, the first part of the book talks about Robert Picton and his background, his family and his growing up. I found that fascinating to read. Was there anything that that could explain this man's behavior and his actions?
I think there was, Joe. I think the fact that he and his brother and sister were shunned at school because they were they came to school smelling of pig manure. They were messy, dirty, smelly. Robert Picton himself had a low normal IQ. He's normal, but it's low. His brother and sister are very bright, and they both done very well. But the family, the home was full of animals roaming in and out, and the kids had to work very, very hard. They were poorly dressed. And I think that the fact that they lived on the top of Dawes Hill in Coquitlam, right really almost as part of the hospitals for the criminally insane, and it was where there were all these buildings and doctors who were dealing with people who were insane or criminally insane, and it was a very difficult place to live. The doctor's children were the only other children that were up there, and they were very well off. So it was almost a nightmarish situation, I think, for the three children.
He's also had a number of pen pals, and he had these tapes that he'd send people with him just talking about his life. Do you know how many pen pals there were?
I don't know how many. I think there were several, and the stories were always the same. Somebody asked me a little while ago whether I would like to interview Picton, and I thought, of course I should say yes, I'm a reporter. And No, actually, I don't want to interview him. I know exactly what he'd say to me. He'd give me the same endless spiel that he gave the pen pals. We heard an audio tape that he sent one of his pen pals, a woman called Victoria, and he whines away about his hard life and his trip to the States and the girl that ditched him and the calf that died, and you just roll your eyes. He tried it on the police, he tried it on everyone he knew, and he would try it on me.
Worthington, do you think he's talking to him?
Worthington?
Peter Worthington?
Well, Peter Worthington's just the man to get him, and he's welcome to him. I've had enough of Robert Picton.
Yeah. In any of the tapes, the letters, has he expressed regret? Has he expressed remorse?
No.
No.
No, this man's a psychopath. I think he loves the attention. That's another reason that I don't want to give him any more attention. I don't think he's that interesting. What's interesting is the forensics of this case, the way the police treated the women who went missing. They didn't care. They didn't, some of them did. But, we all know that the police investigation was a disaster, particularly on the part of the Vancouver police. I was interested in the stories of the women and how they disappeared, and I was very interested in the stories of the forensics and the how they were able to piece together enough evidence to declare that a certain woman was definitely murdered on that farm.
Is there DNA that's been collected that they don't know who it belongs to?
Yes, there's a fair bit of it. I think they have the DNA of maybe two John Does and I think about three to four Jane Does. But there are many families that have prayed that the DNA would match their daughter, that they could then know that that's where she died, and then they would stop looking for her. There was this one woman who disappeared many years ago called Leah Miner, a beautiful young woman whose sister, I spent a lot of time with her sister, and the sister said, "I'm sure she died on the Picton farm, and it was a long time ago, so I think they'll find any DNA in Dave Picton's house before, which would have been before Willie went out to live in his trailer at the back of the property. And that's where almost all the DNA was found, and the body parts and so on were found back there by his trailer. As the prosecutor said, in his backyard. But they did not find Lee Miner's DNA in Dave Picton's property or under the soil, so I think that was their last hope.
Now, you also talked to friends of Picton, right?
Yes.
Yeah, what did they say about him?
Well, they liked him. Willie Picton was generous to his friends. He loaned them money. He gave them food. Most of them didn't like eating any of the pork that he gave them.
Yeah.
And now today, they just you know, can't even bear to think about that. But he was an easygoing guy. He didn't hang out so much with his brothers and all the biker guys that Dave liked to hang out with, very rough guys. And William was more on his own on the property. And he always had some woman that was his best friend. And I interviewed one of them who was his best friend for years, a woman called Lisa Yeltz, who's become a good friend of mine. She's an interesting woman, lots of fun. She was a neighbor of his, and she had a very tough upbringing, very tough time, and had at one point had been on the street herself, been an addict herself. She's been clean and sober and off the street for a long, long time, I think about 25 years. But, you know, she talked to me about why she liked him and the fun they had, and, you know, she... And I could see it, and other women had the same experience. So he had a kind of Jekyll and Hyde personality.
Are there any other people that should be charged?
No, not every. You know, the defense worked very hard to say the other guy did it. You know, they had many other guys that they were sure had committed these murders or committed some of them, but we never heard any compelling evidence that anyone except Robert Picton killed these women.
You mentioned the police investigation. I guess it was Doug Lepard who did that, and he reported back just this past summer saying that there were mistakes.
Yes.
You said that it was a disaster, the investigation of the police department here in Vancouver. Having some experience with public inquiries yourself, will this inquiry headed by Wally Opal, will that achieve much?
I hope it will. I'm skeptical because I know that the families are very upset about Opal's appointment in this case. They feel that because he didn't allow the trial for on the 20 counts to go ahead when he was Attorney General, that he doesn't have their best interests at heart. You know, it was the practical decision. But for them, practicalities don't matter when it comes to their daughter, and they wanted Picton charged and convicted on the murders of their daughters. So they... Wally Opal's not going to have the support of many of the families. Other than that, I think he's probably, in some ways, a very good choice. But, you know, he's got some problems and a lot of people who are very unhappy with his choice. So we'll see what he can do.
And what could happen, essentially? Will there be charges against, say, people at the police department or with a judge or something like that?
I doubt it. They've already... charged and convicted the man in charge of the missing persons department at the Vancouver Police. He was a man who spent most of his time either organizing the VPD's pipe band or trolling for child pornography on his computer. And he was convicted. It was a man called Dragani. I think his first name was John Dragani. John Dragani. And, you know, this was a scandal. He lied to the families about the, you know, any kind of ongoing investigation with regard to their reports. You know, they reported the women missing, and he would lie to them and say that people were looking at it or they had the file or something. He hadn't done anything. And so that was a terrible mess. But he's already been convicted on this other issue and gone, and they have certainly beefed up their missing persons unit. A lot of the police officers who refuse to do anything about this are long gone. They've been gone for years. You know, they brought in a new police chief to clean up the department about 2002. And awkwardly for me, he turned out to be my cousin.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had to steer very clear of the Vancouver police to save us both. But, you know, they did clean up the police department, and, you know, it was a long time ago. I don't know whether they'll go back and fish around among the senior brass of the VPD to go after them or not.
Now, our friend Rafe Mayer, in reviewing your book, made mention about, and I've been thinking about this since while reading it, about how this book makes us Vancouverites look and the view that we have of ourselves. What do you think this whole matter says about how we view the downtown East Side, how we view the missing women?
I think a lot has changed. I mean, I could see the change, you know, actually with Larry Campbell's victory when he became mayor of Vancouver in 2002, I think it was the fall of 2002.
Mm-hmm.
one of the things that he campaigned on was the missing women's issue. And I remember when he said in his victory speech, you know, no one in this city is disposable. This issue united people in voting for Larry Campbell. And he, you know, he's long been an advocate for the Downtown East Side, and a whole television series is built around his work as a coroner, dealing with that community as well. So I think people are very upset about what happened. I don't know what will happen with the inquiry, but I know that there are some good changes happening. I mean, I have really believed that nothing was changing in the Downtown East Side, but I think I was wrong, Joe. I think that there are changes happening. I think that there are people who are determined to fix it, but it's going to be a very expensive fix, and it's going to take a long time to do it.
You mentioned that you don't want to talk to Robert Picton.
Blame me?
No, I don't. You've written a book that's just under 800 pages, plus the previous book. You know a great deal about the case. What do you still want to know?
What do I still want to know? I want to know... I would like to know who Jane Doe is. I would still like to know who the other Jane Does are on the property so that those families can know for sure. You know how they found... well, you probably know this, but you... Maybe for your listeners, how people found out how they matched the DNA of the women? You know, they went to the BC Cancer Center, and where every woman who has a pap smear in this province has the pap smear goes to the BC Cancer Center and is kept there. So they were able to get DNA from the farm and run it through the BC Cancer Center, and that's how they got the hits, because sex trade workers are very careful about their health. You know, they all have all kinds of health problems, and they all work hard to take care of their health. And as sex trade workers, they all have pap smears. So they were able to match up just about everybody except Jane Doe and the one whose account was quashed by the trial judge, Jim Williams. But there are a couple of other Jane Does on that property, maybe up to four, I think, as I mentioned earlier, and I'd like to know who they are. But I think I know... I'm interested in the forensic. I'd love to know more about the forensics of this case. I wrote a great deal about that, but, you know, it just interests me, so I'd like to know more about that. But I think I spent 8 years on this book and a great deal of time studying this case before that. So I think maybe I'm done.
Yeah. When we talked last, for the previous book, you talked about Elaine Allen and who she was. You dedicate the book to her.
Yes.
Who was she?
Who is she?
Who is she?
She's
That's right.
So very much with us. Elaine Allen's wonderful. She was completely unknown to me until I got the assignment to do the book. And so when I was researching it before I came out here, I started going through all the newspaper clippings for years and saw her name repeatedly as a woman who was commenting on the fate of the missing women. She had been running WISH, which was a drop-in center for the prostitutes at First United Church in the Downtown East Side. And I called her. I had to start somewhere, so I called her, and it turned out that she was a fan of mine from another world. She had worked in a conservative cabinet minister's office in Ottawa as a media advisor, and she loved my book On the Take. So she said, yes, of course, I'll help you. And when I got out here, she met me right away, and she has helped me ever since and become one of my dearest friends. And, you know, she testified at the trial on behalf of the missing women because they felt that the prosecutors felt that somebody needed to be there to talk on behalf of the women and explain what they were like. And, you know, she knew so many of them, and she fought so hard for them, and she fought so hard to have an investigation. And so she introduced me to many of the women in the Downtown East Side, including several who told me stories about their relationships or their encounters with Picton, and one woman who was a bank robber who had spent spent a great deal of time in prison, and Elaine met her in prison when she was a prison visitor and met her there. And she had an encounter with Picton and survived it. So she was just remains a wonderful help and a wonderful friend.
Stevie, what's next for you?
I've just been thinking a lot about that. I don't know. I'm wondering about fiction, you know.
Yeah.
I'd like to write some fiction, and I just don't know, but I don't know if there's another big story that I've found that would interest me as much as this, so I'm just thinking about it. That's a bad question. It gets me down. It gets me depressed. I don't know yet.
And there won't be another book on Mulrooney Schreiber for me?
I don't think so. I'm sick of them.
Yeah.
I'm tired of them, and I'm tired of Robert Picton. I loved the book, but I loved working on this book, and I loved working on the other books, but, you know, it's time for something different, and I don't know what that is yet.
This is a great achievement, and I said earlier, a necessary one. Congratulations, Stevie, on it, and continued good luck with the book.
Thank you, Joe. I really appreciate that.
You're very welcome. The website for more is steviecameron.com. Stevie Cameron on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.